Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a look at what the Iranian elections might mean. Is the refugee crisis from Africa, Middle East, and South Asia worsening? Scientists give new hope to controlling locust swarms.
It was an enclosed arena, an area, where locusts were put into so that you could look at them a lot closer than trying to find millions of them, of
in
course.
The wild.
Right, in the wild.
Catch a couple in the wild.
A little hard to figure out what they're doing when there's millions of them.
And we'll look at the winning film at the Oscars. It's right here on The Voice of America. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and his allies have won 15 out of Tehran's 16 seats in an election for the country's important 88-member Assembly of Experts. Joining me here in the studio to talk about the development is Arash Sagarchi of our Persian service. Welcome, Arash.
Hello.
Can you share some of the details of this election?
We had the two elections in Iran on Friday. The first one was the election for parliament. All 30 seats for Tehran, the capital city, were elected just reformist. And in the entire country, more than half are reformist and moderate. That is a big change in recent 12 years because, you know, for 12 years, the conservatives, they had a parliament, they had a government, and since 2013, a lot of change happened in Iran. Also, the election of Assembly of Experts at the same time was in Iran, and that was very important. The result shows moderates got win too.
So what does this mean for the nation, really?
Actually, Rouhani, Hassan Rouhani, the president, needed this parliament. The current parliament is a mix of conservatives and also extremists in Iran. So it can help Rouhani to make, you know, a better economy in Iran. Also, some expect to have more freedom by this parliament, of course. Frankly, more free law can be set by this parliament. We hear from a lady was elected from Tehran yesterday. She said the hijab is not mandatory. And this is new for many Iranians to hear that from a parliament member.
Well, does this reflect a major change in the attitude of the whole nation towards the West?
It should be. You know, right now, foreign policy is in supreme leader's hand. And but in the parliament, it means you will hear less, actually. You will hear less against the West from the new parliament member. 3 months ago, when Iran deal was considered in Iranian parliament, many extremists chanted death to U.S. and they were against the deal. But right now, many of them, they are not right now in the parliament for next parliament. And also, since next June, when the new members get the office, the parliament attitude will be more soft with Western countries.
Well, let me ask you this. The supreme leader, will this in any way change his positions on anything?
No, the supreme leader, no, there is no expectation to change his situation. But, you know, I think he was angry to this big change. Like last presidential election, many people believe that he is not angry to give power to moderates. But maybe he thought moderates can have a better deal and negotiation with West.
This might end up with a different relationship with the United States.
Maybe in future, why not?
Okay, well, thank you very much for visiting us here in the studio, Raj.
Thank you for having me.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today concerning the race for the White House. And joining me with details is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome every day, Andrew.
Thank you very much. Good to be here every day.
Thank you. Say, Andrew, I understand that Donald Trump has become embroiled in a bit of a Twitter controversy.
Yeah, there's actually two Twitter controversies that Donald Trump's become embroiled in. The first actually didn't start on Twitter. It started in an interview with CNN here in the United States, where Donald Trump, to make a long story short, refused to disavow David Duke and a group called the Ku Klux Klan, which is a white supremacist group.
David's the head of that organization.
And David Duke is the head of that organization. So Donald Trump took to Twitter to defend himself or backtrack. He actually posted a video on Twitter where the previous day he said he disavowed David Duke and the group, and he blamed it on a poor audio connection. He said he couldn't hear the interviewer's question, but he immediately went to social media to try to address that controversy and stop it before it took hold. Now, another controversy he's facing on Twitter is a quote that he tweeted out. It was a retweet that he did on his account and said, "It is better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep." And he said, "Oh, I like this quote. It's a great quote. I'm going to tweet this out." Well, the problem was the quote is from Mussolini.
Whoa.
And it turns out that it was actually the political satire and commentary website Gawker actually tricked him into kind of retweeting this. They've been tweeting these quotes at him, hoping he would bite, and he finally did. So he had to backtrack that, something that started on Twitter, and then he had to backtrack in interviews.
Our listeners might remember that Mussolini was during the World War II period and was not liked by the European countries.
Yes, as a fascist dictator in Italy. So I asked him in this interview, "Do you want to be associated with a fascist?" And he had to backtrack that Twitter comment.
Donald Trump also might have had some spelling issues. Which one of his rivals jumped on this issue?
Well, that was Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida. Donald Trump had sent out two tweets where he'd misspelled some words. He meant to say choker, calling Marco Rubio a choker, and he spelled it chocker. He added an extra C. And then he said, "Poll said I won the debate. It's a great honor," but he spelled honor H-O-N-E-R instead of H-O-N-O-R. So Marco Rubio jumped on that, saying he can't spell, he can't tweet. Part of the back and forth between those two candidates.
And what about the Democrats? Any big social news from that camp?
Yeah, well, going back to the story about Donald Trump and the Ku Klux Klan, Bernie Sanders, running for president, senator from Vermont, tweeted out and said, "America's first black president cannot and will not be succeeded by a hate monger who refuses to condemn the KKK. Interestingly, Hillary Clinton actually retweeted that tweet. So they said it's a first for her. They believe it's the first time she's retweeted him. And it's kind of unheard of for a candidate to retweet their rival and to give their rival publicity. But it just speaks to how united they are on this issue and how much they want to oppose Mr. Trump.
Well, yeah, they're united on this one.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
About 8 years ago, a pair of astronomers were going through some archival data gathered by a radio telescope when they discovered a mysterious and powerful burst of radio waves that lasted only a few milliseconds. Astronomers at Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia detected another of these fast radio bursts last April and alerted other observatories to their discovery. Soon, a number of radio and optical telescope facilities around the world joined in the search for the signal. After examining a visual image of the FRB taken a day after the first burst, scientists think they've found where it came from. It may have originated at a location in an elliptical galaxy some 6 billion light years away. Some of the scientists involved in making the finding are also suggesting that these fast radio bursts could generate gravitational waves such as those detected recently by the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thousands of refugees and migrants are still stuck in makeshift camps in Greece as its Balkan neighbors continue to deny them passage north and west. The Greek migration minister said up to 70,000 may be stranded in the coming month, triple the current number. Macedonia has refused entry to Afghans and limited the entry of Syrians and Iraqis. Austria is also limiting asylum applications and migrant flows. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has criticized what he calls the European Union's misguided immigration policy and is seeking to block an EU migrant quota system. Lawrence Brown is a visiting fellow in European Studies at the Australian National University and also serves on the faculty of the University of Manchester in the UK. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, improving weather means a greater influx of people from Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia escaping war and poverty.
There's a real concern that not only will Greece become a new kind of focus for migration, but that after 9 years of austerity and cutbacks within the state, that what social services there are to support these migrants will really be exhausted very quickly.
How is the European Union going to deal with this latest crisis?
Well, Europe has tried to reallocate migrants from September. After several months of trying to reallocate these migrants, it hasn't been very effective. So the numbers that were involved, I mean, are only about a quarter of the estimated migrants passing through Greece and Italy. So I think what Europe will increasingly try and do is focus on tightening border controls across the Mediterranean, so relying much more on maritime controls, and reinforcing its efforts to negotiate agreements with Turkey to, in a sense, prevent migrants moving on from Turkey.
Well, how successful might they be? Turkey's already bursting at the seams with millions of refugees.
Yes, but I guess the wider picture is that Turkey and Europe have been engaged in a prolonged conversation and negotiation about Turkey's membership, potential membership to the EU. So certainly that is something that I think is very much kind of shaping the willingness of Turkey to kind of listen to European concerns and to engage with them, although the Turks seem to be doing a very good job at negotiating large payments of development money and humanitarian relief to, in a sense, facilitate holding huge numbers of refugees.
Meanwhile, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban is doubling down on his resistance to European quotas for migrants and refugees.
Yes, and it's striking in a way because Hungary, you know, almost half a century ago, defined what a refugee was when there was the huge exodus of refugees from Hungary during the Cold War, about a quarter of a million people. Refugees became seen as a permanent condition. And so the UN created new institutions to deal with that. And so it's interesting that Hungary today very much has placed itself under Orban at the kind of forefront of opposition to these movements. And yet Hungary is still very much a migrant country. So there are tens of thousands of Hungarians migrating to Germany, to Britain, to other parts of Western Europe. So at the same time that Orban is saying that the EU is a failure, he's also attacking the UK government for discrimination against Hungarian migrants by not following EU regulations.
And Lawrence Brown says only about a third of migrants asking for refugee status actually got it in 2014, allowing them to stay in European Union permanently. He says a real challenge for EU authorities will be what to do with the vast majority who will be undocumented people who are asking to leave but refuse to return to their home country. Coming up on International Edition, using math to fight locusts and the winning film at the Academy Awards. A swarm of locusts, often of millions of bugs, can destroy an entire cropland in minutes. Insecticides are used to try to control the clouds of bugs, but many poor nations from Africa to South America to Asia can't afford the resources. But a team of researchers in England is working on the problem and has created a mathematical model of a locust swarm to help create new strategies. Correspondent Deborah Block is following this problem and has joined me here in the studio. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you very much, Susan.
So, what did the researchers find?
Very interesting to use a mathematical model, something very new. This group of researchers, first of all, what they did is they used some film that was filmed in Adelaide, Australia. And it was an enclosed arena, an area, where locusts were put into, so that you could look at them a lot closer than trying to find millions of them, of
in
course.
The wild.
Right, in the wild.
Catch a couple in the wild.
A little hard to figure out what they're doing when there's millions of them. And so what they did is they watched them, of course, and they discovered that while swarming, that the locusts usually move in the same direction as their immediate neighbors. But then they spontaneously switch direction as a group. So they thought, well, why do they do that? So they thought, well, let's try putting a few locusts in this arena. And they found out, well, they don't pay any attention to each other. But he said, as soon as you put more in there, one of the scientists said, they start to march together in the same direction, either clockwise or counterclockwise. And this becomes something that they do spontaneously. So then again, they'll all switch direction at the same time and move around, which is what they actually do when they're, you know, eating all the cropland. So the scientists thought, well, how do they even start a swarm? So they figured out that it doesn't take a whole lot of locusts to do this. The most important thing that they found is if you just put two locusts in one direction and you put one coming in another direction, the two locusts can turn around this individual. So what this all means, Susan, is there is a mathematical formula to how they move. And now they're trying to figure out how can we use this to try to control them.
What might this mathematical model lead to?
Well, these scientists are thinking that since these locusts are sensitive to uncertainty, that maybe aircraft like a helicopter or an airplane could help break up this swarm. So that would create disturbances in the air that might get them confused. Other possibilities they're thinking is maybe perhaps using some sort of ultrasonic device to disturb the locusts. But for now, as you mentioned already, the best ways that the farmers, scientists know of right now is just insecticide, which isn't necessarily the best things to use. People like to find other ways. It's hard to use it because this is involving huge areas. And so the best way for now, scientists say, is to try to prevent the insects from breeding and swarming in the first place. But they're still working on that, too.
Well, the thing about locusts is that they are edible. You can't eat them.
Yes, you know, I knew you were going to ask that question. That is so funny. I was thinking, I bet Susan's going to ask me about that. Yes, indeed. There are actually different types of locusts. I mean, they are obviously all related. And people do eat them, just like they do grasshoppers, since they're in the same family.
Mm-hmm.
And with millions of them out there, I am sure there are plenty to choose from if people so desire and want to eat them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for stopping by.
You're welcome.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Spotlight, a look at the Boston Globe's investigation into child sex abuse in the Catholic Church, won the Oscar for Best Picture at the 88th Academy Awards, beating out strong contenders that included The Revenant, Mad Max, Room, and Bridge of Spies. Penelope Pulu has this look at the award-winning film.
The Boston priest molested kids in six different parishes over the last 30 years. The church found out about it and did nothing.
Boston Globe editor Marty Baron, played by Liev Schreiber, assigns Spotlight, the paper's investigative team, to look into mounting evidence that scores of Catholic priests sexually abused young victims and that senior clergy covered up the abuse.
We need to focus on the institution, not the individual priests. Practice and policy. Show me the church manipulated the system so that these guys wouldn't have to face charges. Show me they put those same priests back into parishes time and time again. Show me this was systemic, that it came from the top down.
Marty Baron, the Globe's newly appointed executive editor, was not from Boston and not a Catholic, so he could see the story with fresh eyes.
But in Boston, I was called an outsider. And you know, vocabulary says a lot. It signals a lot. And I was viewed as someone who was not from Boston and not of Boston.
While digging, the Spotlight team met a wall of secrecy.
We understand you've settled several cases against the church.
I can't discuss that.
There aren't any records of any of these settlements.
Nope.
Gradually, they discover that the scope of the Boston Archdiocese cover-up of the 70 pedophile priests was as large as the incidents of abuse themselves.
It's time, Robbie! It's time. They knew, and they let it happen to kids.
Spotlight has been hailed as one of the best films this year for its stellar ensemble cast, its taut and intelligent script, its focused and deliberate story arc. But as screenwriter Josh Singer says, the film is powerful because it reminds people how free investigative journalism can upend even the most powerful corrupt institutions.
It really was a world-changing piece of reporting in a way that, you know, it's amazing, you know, this very local story becomes international.
Oscar-nominated director Tom McCarthy says this is also a story of courage and integrity by the reporters who risked their reputations to make the church's abuse of power public.
Ultimately, in many ways, this movie for me is about faith, different types of faith, but faith. And I think it's something that at some point or another, we all wrestle with.
This is not just Boston, it's a whole country, it's a whole world.
They knew, and they let it happen. It could have been you, it could have been me, it could have been any of us.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
At the Academy Awards Sunday night, Leonardo DiCaprio got a standing ovation when he won his first Oscar. The veteran actor won for his leading role, portrayal of an unrelenting frontiersman who drags himself across kilometers of snow to get revenge. DiCaprio thanked the cast and crew of The Revenant for creating a transcendent cinematic experience. He also warned in his acceptance speech that climate change is real, recalling that Revenant filmmakers had to go to the southern tip of the planet just to find snow. Revenant director Alejandro Iñárritu won the Best Director category for the second straight year after winning last year for Birdman. In addition, Emmanuel Lubezki made history with his third consecutive Oscar for cinematography for his work on The Revenant. Brie Larson, who was widely expected to win the Oscar for Best Actress, did not disappoint, winning the prize. We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Coca-Cola Company have announced support for a new program in Nigeria under the Water and Development Alliance, also known as the WADA Project. The $2 million project will provide up to 100,000 citizens in Cross River State with access to safe drinking water and good sanitation facilities by 2019. This joint investment is aligned with USAID and Coca-Cola's shared focus on clean water provision as a means to help build healthy, sustainable communities in Nigeria. The U.S. government is committed to engaging in effective and innovative alliances with committed partners to support Nigeria's critical development needs, said William Stoyer, acting U.S. Consul General in Lagos. We are proud to collaborate with Coca-Cola to bring a sustainable and safe water solution to thousands of people in Nigeria, he added. During the signing event, USAID Mission Director to Nigeria, Michael Harvey, said, "Today we are consolidating a special partnership, one in which a private firm has joined with a U.S. government agency to contribute to a priority set by the government of Nigeria." USAID and Coca-Cola have collaborated in Nigeria since 2007. The partnership has improved water resource management and expanded sustainable access to safe drinking water and sanitation services in Kano and in Yugu states. The Water Project helps to control and prevent water-related diseases such as cholera, typhoid, and diarrhea by providing water and sanitation services, hygiene education, and establishing water, environment, and sanitation committees in communities where the project works. This new agreement will provide a framework to implement WADA and to allow the parties to establish a range of policy issues to achieve their shared objectives in Nigeria. The United States is proud to work with Nigeria and its international and private sector partners to give the Nigerian people better access to something all human beings need, safe drinking water.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.